Welcome to International Dispute Negotiation, your guide to resolving disputes everywhere.
This is Mike McElrath, and this podcast is about different ways of accepting and managing the risks of dispute resolution, presenting them through the eyes of experts from different countries and backgrounds. In this episode of IDN, we look at corporate social responsibility and mediation as a response to some of the challenges of globalization.
Hello, I'm Caroline Rees, and I work for the Corporate Social Responsibility Initiative, which is part of the Harvard University's Kennedy School.
Caroline Rees and her colleagues at Harvard work with Professor John Ruggie, Special Representative of the United Nations Secretary General for Business and Human Rights. They look at the types of problems that can arise when companies undertake operations in far-off places and their activities have an impact directly or indirectly on the people who live there. The idea is that by implementing systems that blend formal dispute resolution with informal or traditional methods of resolving problems, businesses and locals can jump ahead of their conflicts in order to achieve a sustainable future.
There's one colleague that we work with who does a lot of this work with mining companies. You know, he often talks about go and sit under the mango tree. You know, that's where this stuff happens in so many communities.
It's a very different approach from one of invest, build, operate, move on, and then litigate over the consequences. Instead, it's a sort of East meets West that peaceably intersects through the flexibility offered by mediation.
We started out saying, well, look, let's just understand what's out there. Let's try and work out what actually is populating this space that people can use and can turn to. So we started out mapping all of that. And then we had to say, well, that's all well and good. We've now got a good sense of what's provided by international organizations and national governments and industry organizations and companies. But what actually makes any of these mechanisms effective? And so we started to look more into these questions of effectiveness. More and more as we looked through this, particularly as we got down to the level where the company is interacting directly with communities, benefits of what one would perhaps broadly call dialogue-based approaches, but including mediation, became so salient in terms of effectiveness and legitimacy as well. We increasingly were saying, okay, well, there are different forms of adjudication. There's non-judicial as well as judicial adjudication, but there's also this place for negotiation and mediation, and how do we understand better how that space can be used to the benefit of both communities and companies when they find themselves in conflict?
So let's take a concrete example of the sort of problems that you're seeing in terms of corporate social responsibility. And you sent me a very interesting article today, by the way, of written by a lawyer in the UK who's mediated. It actually said nice things about mediating conflict between government organizations and parties who've been injured in different countries. Mm-hmm. So if you give an example of the sort of needs that you see that could be addressed.
Yeah. Well, what I find one can often get sort of stuck talking about the extractive sector too much in this, but I think there's a reason for that.
When you say the extractive sector, you mean, for example, minerals, oil, gas?
Exactly, right. And forestry is, I guess, the other sort of that gets lumped in with that, I suppose, natural resources there. Extractives in terms of mining, oil, gas. And the reason I think there's so much focus on that sector is simply because of the large physical footprint that it necessarily has and the fact that it has to go where the resources are. And so that often, and increasingly these days, is pushing these companies into environments where there is particular fragility, if not existing conflict, conflict propensity. And so classic cases, come in various iterations, but it's similar stories. Company going into an area where there may be local populations. Those populations may increase once they see that a company is coming in. Some in the population might be from indigenous communities, particularly disenfranchised. And the company needs to take over land, either temporarily to lay a pipeline or permanently to extract resources due to a license that they have from the government. And individuals in the community start to balk at what's happening and the way it's being done. It may be that they feel that the compensation that's being offered is derisory or is not being given on an equal and non-discriminatory basis. They may feel that the company is bringing in unskilled labor from the capital when they have that labor locally and should be benefiting from the development, not being marginalized by it. It may be that there are differences between communities that get exacerbated by the presence of the company. It may be over relocation of communities and the quality of the location they feel that they're being rehoused in. These are all the kinds of issues that can arise, as well as allegations of pollution of a water source that's used for washing or for drinking or for feeding cattle. Right down to day-to-day annoyances about trucks running through a community and kicking up dust that lands on people's food and washing and so on. If there aren't means of picking these up, picking up these problems, these irritants, identifying them and finding ways to manage and mitigate them with those affected, they tend to compound over time and create an environment of grievance, even if there isn't a single emblematic moment that creates a conflict. And so you see this sort of degeneration in relations that then means that when something serious does go wrong, there is no ability to absorb that in the relationship. It does tend to lead to a much larger scale conflict with greater impacts. And so what we're looking at often is how can the company equip itself to find the problems in the small beginnings, have the systems that prevent their escalation.
Before they escalate. I mean, it's a great example of how disputes can escalate from small beginnings to devastating and terrible outcomes.
That's it. Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. And so we try and look at both ends of the equation. We're actually just starting some work to try and work out models for understanding the costs of conflict if you're not, as it were, investing your time, thinking, and to some extent your resources identifying and managing them early on, you know, so that one can understand a little bit more what the business case, the straight up business case, right, is for not ending up in that worst case scenario.
Well, it's an analog, right, to what we in the business world would say is the benefit of early dispute resolution, right? You identify a dispute early on, and your costs of exiting are phenomenally lower than they are than if you try to resolve a dispute once it's in its more mature stages, when the parties' positions have solidified, they've already spent a lot of money, and it's very difficult to get them to move away from that.
Exactly so. And what's interesting to see is that it does seem to be that surprising, but it's a certain leap of imagination, I think, for many to apply the same logic that so many companies, I think, these days apply to business conflicts, to apply that to business to social stakeholder conflicts.
Well, but at the end of the day, we're all applying the same thing, which is just basic human nature, I think.
Right. Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. So. And yet the those on the other side are perhaps more of an unknown quantity. Maybe that's right. Part of the difference. They don't talk the business language, and NGOs get involved and different kinds of media coverage get involved and so on. So it becomes or feels perhaps a much more... perhaps a much more sort of scary environment in which to embrace the idea of mediation.
But you have it, at least you see the possibility for mediation in these contexts. And how are you going about doing it?
Well, as we looked at the question, you know, what does it mean to have an effective mechanism for handling community and other social grievances as a company? John Ruggie articulated a set of principles that was underpinned by research that we'd done, sort of shockingly radical principles, you know, to do with accessibility, having a predictable process, certain levels of transparency around it, and so on. So there's a body of work that we've done around that and some guidance we developed for companies and their stakeholders to think through the issues that underlie those principles. And so one of the things we're doing now that you allude to there is that we're piloting those principles with some companies, an oil and gas company, a mining company, coal mining company, a food retailer, a garment company, and an electronics industry company to really say, okay, well, that's fine. Now let's see what happens when the rubber hits the road and you're in really quite different operating environments, both in terms of sector and culture and so on and so forth.
I'm imagining that you're working in places where mediation may not yet be accepted as an idea for resolving disputes. So how would you propose it? How do you get the parties to go along with the idea?
Yeah, well, that's a good question. That's something we're grappling with. What's surprising is I think
By the way, I grapple with that all the time because it happens all the time in commercial disputes when you work internationally. And just in some jurisdictions, people have never heard of mediation.
Yes,
and it's
yes.
a real challenge.
It is. There's a huge amount of misunderstanding in civil society about what mediation is, and I think also some lack of awareness also in companies as to what it can offer in this kind of a context.
Right. So you have an information problem on both sides of the equation. Yeah.
We do. What's also interesting, though, is that, I mean, you say that mediation, you know, may not be developed in some of these environments or sort of imply that. And that's certainly true in some environments, but in others, it's extremely rich in mediation. It's just not, you know, stamped with a sort of a Western organization's qualification. But, you know, many traditional communities, as you know as well as anyone, have modes of facilitation and mediation of conflict very much in their DNA. So there are quite often people on the ground who play this role within the societies and amongst communities on an ongoing basis. In some of the successful cases we've seen, actually, the company has deferred to some degree to the communities to find the person from their traditions that they trust to come into this kind of role, either as a sole mediator or working with someone else. One colleague that we work with who does a lot of this work with mining companies, you know, he often talks about go and sit under the mango tree. You know, that's where this stuff happens in so many communities. You know, there's the equivalent of the banyan tree or the mango tree or whatever, where stuff gets worked out. And so, you know, it's a question of looking at those structures and working with those structures and finding ways to bring them together with any more formal processes that are needed. And I think part of the future is going to need to be collaborative approaches also that bring those local traditional capacities together with the sort of skill bases that go with formal mediation in the sense that you and I are talking about the understanding of what mediation is.
It's a very interesting use of mediation, by the way, to really tap into also the flexibility of the process.
Yes.
That, you know, that the parties themselves own that and can say, look, we're going to do this the way that we think would best help us to achieve a good outcome here. Mm-hmm. And not go by just a standard way that let's do it because it's the way other people have done it.
Right, exactly. And that's why there's really no one-size-fits-all in this space.
Can you give some examples, though, of some mediations that have actually taken place using these forms or these hybrid forms that you've talked of?
There's an interesting example. I mentioned it in passing, the Tintaya mine in Peru,
right.
Where that was owned at the time by BHP Billiton, and there were major disputes arising with communities around some of the impacts of the operation. And what they did at the time, they actually worked with a local mediator who continues to do a lot of facilitation and mediation work in Peru. And he came in and worked with company and communities and the local NGOs who were very well organized. Oxfam, both Oxfam America and Oxfam Australia, interestingly, were involved because Oxfam Australia had a mining ombudsman at the time and were following BHP Billiton under that. And with these different parties, they actually managed to with mediation, agree on a series of so-called dialogue tables. And they set up four dialogue tables on different subjects, including human rights and I think sustainable development was one of them, and water and so on, and land. And each of these dialogue tables, as I say, had a different theme and was there to work through the existing disagreements and try and reach some resolution. Now, what's interesting is that they then became not just a means to do that in the short term, but they're still operating today. And I was talking to the guy who mediated that just the other day, and he says that they're now looking to move to a second generation. And they're now saying, well, that's all fine, but we've got to look now at a sustainable future, not just at solving problems now. We've got to look at what happens beyond the life of the mine. What do we want to be as communities into the future? How do we want to grow? And so they're actually morphing this structure to have, again, the same actors at the table talking about what is the future of these communities and how are we all going to be players in constructing that.
Very interesting. So the mine will leave, but the process will remain with the community.
Right. And right now, this is still with the mine involved, talking about the sustainable future, because, you know, the nature of mining is there's post-closure issues. You leave, but there are issues of, what does that mean for the environment? What does it mean for the communities that have gained employment out of the presence of the mine, and suddenly that has gone? So there's a sort of we talked earlier about the impact of a mine coming into a community. There's an impact of a mine leaving a community. Yeah, and so that's part of the discussion as well, and that the mine is involved in that second generation of discussions.
Do you find a lot of resistance where you've got people who are saying, you know, don't do this? I mean, litigation is the better path. This is where you should be going. You need to defend this is rights-based. We should not be operating, you know, on trying to find solutions based on the immediate interests, but trying to establish the rights of the people who are being affected?
Absolutely. Particularly, I would say, you know, international human rights advocacy NGOs, and for perfectly good reasons, human rights have been fought for as an international law concept. It was secured a fairly short time ago in human history. And so for many advocacy organizations, maintaining the debate in the legal realm and through legal and judicial institutions becomes an important one. Combined with the fact that if you're looking at that sort of international systemic level, your priority is perhaps more around sending big international messages that you can get out of a major lawsuit that happens, or a major settlement that occurs, or a judicial finding of an opinion that comes down, rather than through small-scale, localized agreements that are reached. So I don't take issue at all with the reasons why particularly international NGOs tend to focus very strongly on litigation. But I do find quite a discrepancy between that and many of the non-international and much more grassroots organizations for whom the priority is solving this for these people now, rather than entering a multi-year process of uncertain end to aim for a litigated outcome.
What I have found is that everybody needs educating on what mediation can do.
Yeah, absolutely so. Absolutely so. And I think, you know, to the other point you raise, you know, in the context of human rights, just how much space there is in and around the parameters of human rights to involve interests. So mediation doesn't become undermining rights or compromising rights. It's about recognizing that within the concept of your right to food, or right to an adequate standard of housing, or right to family life, there are very many different ways in which you as an individual might understand that in practice. And so there's a real space there for mediation to play a role, even whilst recognizing the rights nature of what's being discussed.
Well, it's fascinating, Caroline. Thank you. I mean, you're looking at some very profound conflict, and yet you're finding opportunity in it, you know, to make the world a better place for the people who live in places that are affected by those conflicts.
It's fascinating. It's going to keep everybody on our side busy for a long time, and many others besides. But it is fascinating, and I think it's hopeful. I really do.
Well, let's hope that you're a huge success. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Michael.
You've been listening to International Dispute Negotiation. This podcast is presented by the International Institute for Conflict Prevention and Resolution, CPR. CPR is a membership-based nonprofit organization that promotes excellence and innovation in public and private dispute resolution, providing an international resource for the avoidance, management, and resolution of business disputes. For further information about CPR, or to download archived versions of this podcast, go to www.cpradr.org. Questions about this podcast or the issues discussed can be addressed to idn@cpradr.org. The music of Note Noir is used with permission.